Welcome to The Drummer's Pathway, the podcast about music, life, and the creative process. I'm Michael Scott, and welcome to The Drummer's Pathway podcast. This episode features my conversation with drummer Dave Patel. Actively involved in the Toronto music scene for over 30 years as a professional drummer, Dave has played on over 70 albums, many jingles, and has worked extensively with numerous artists in different genres, demonstrating his ability to adapt to any musical situation. He was a student at both York University and Humber College, and studied privately with Jim Blackley, Paul DeLong, Vito Reza, among others. Dave is also an in-demand educator who has taught privately in the Toronto area for over 20 years. Currently, he is a faculty member at the renowned Metalworks Institute, where he is actively involved in their music performance and technology program. In our conversation, we talk about the importance of experiencing live music situations because you never know where that inspiration will take you. We also discuss his approaches to teaching and why it's essential to not get caught up in self-deprecation and to remain committed to following your own desired path. And now, my conversation with Dave Patel. You have been a professional drummer and active in the Toronto music scene for well over 30 years. And during that time, you have gone on to record on over 70 albums, plus perform in numerous musical scenarios. In addition to that, you also are an in-demand educator, and for over 20 plus years as a private instructor, plus you have been on faculty at the acclaimed Metalworks Institute. Where did all of this journey really begin for you?
Well, I kind of want to give my mom credit, you know, because the truth is she played all sorts of music in the house when I was a kid. We listened to everything from Duke Ellington, Earth, Wind & Fire, Miriam Makeba, you know, music from all over the globe, from different types of rock and roll, funk, R&B. You know, it was just, if it was music, most of the time she liked it. She had a great classical collection, everything. And then, you know, when I got into junior high, I got given the trombone, but I wanted to play drums. And then at the end of junior high in grade 9, I had a great music teacher, Ann Cohen, and she suggested that I audition for the School for the Arts on trombone. It was Claude Watts and Earl Haig. And, you know, the spring before leaving junior high, my mom had all these great albums, and she put on this album, Earth, Wind, and Fire. And the tune on this, I think it's called I Am, the album. And the first tune on is In the Stone. And I heard that tune, and when the horns came in, I was like, I want to do that. You know, it wasn't a Neil Peart or Rush or Buddy Rich or anything like that that got me into drumming. It was Earth, Wind, and Fire, to be honest, you know. And then she just started taking me to tons of concerts that summer alone. And I'll tell you why in a sec. But that summer alone, I saw Buddy Rich, Jaco Pastorius, Oscar Peterson. I think I saw Buddy Rich twice that summer. Spyro Gyra, all these different bands from different styles of music. Man, my mom sat in the parking lot outside of Maple Leaf Gardens when my friend and I went to see Saga play, you know, at Maple Leaf Gardens. She was just like, yeah, you want to see music? Okay, great, I'll take you. You know, she took me to see she got free tickets from her boss at work, and we sat in the front row to see the Toronto Symphony at Massey Hall. Blew my mind, you know. Just the sound coming off the stage alone was just, you know, the way it resonates in your body. But at the audition to get into the school for trombone, these two great music teachers, John Franks and this guy Ken Jones, who is a great educator, and there are a lot of people that play music now because of Ken Jones. I just saw him a few weeks ago. But they said, so what do you like about playing trombone? I was like, nothing. Nothing. I want to play drums, you know. And they said, okay, if you take a few lessons over the summer, we'll let you in, you know, because obviously you're passionate about it. And my mom had started taking me to all these concerts. So those were the two events that set me out on the path. And I felt, you know, genuinely kind of spoiled that I had, you know, that much opportunity right from the get-go.
I'm passionate about attending live performance, and I've been over the years to hundreds and hundreds of concerts, anything from symphony to jazz to funk to thrash metal to everything kind of in between. And each one of them has been a really incredibly inspiring experience, both positive and negative. There's always things that you can take away from these situations. And sometimes it's, that is not something I want to do. And other times it's, this unexpectedly is something that really spoke to me. But I'm always amazed these days when I talk to people on how few people actually partake in the live music experience. Music now is something it's kind of like it's online, it's through streaming, it's through YouTube, and all of those have some validity to them because now we have access to things that we never had access to before, but there's nothing like that live music experience. And it's interesting now just seeing that perspective that people are coming from, you know, the opposite end now where it's kind of like getting away from those environments. And I think if it wasn't for the fact that I actually took the time to stand in line, to buy tickets, to drive to a lot of these events, often by myself, I never really would have become the musician that I am today.
Yeah. Man, there is nothing like a bit of legwork to appreciate what you know, really, I hate to use these terms, but what you're getting in return, you know, like that the sonic experience of a live event is a completely different experience than seeing something online. And while I think it's fantastic that we have access to things like Miles Davis live, you know, unplugged the whatever, what was it? The Nickel, Plug Nickel,
yeah,
you know, that Plug concert. Nickel,
yeah.
Oh my God. You know, as soon as a friend told me about YouTube, because I was late to the computer party, that was the first thing I went to watch, because somebody had given me a bootleg cassette of that concert. And of course, Tony was ferocious, and you know, he didn't play jazz lightly. And I was so drawn to that type of energy. It was great to be able to experience it online. But when I saw Tony live, you know, I remember that. I remember the feeling of that. I remember the sonic, like, I just felt like I had this sonic battery. And especially because it was the first time I saw Tony was at the Ontario Place Forum, mm-hmm. and it rotated, right? And when his back was towards me, we were about four rows up in the seats. And, you know, I was a teenager. I had tears in my eyes because I just couldn't believe what this guy, with the sound this guy was putting out.
Which show was that one?
That was the Tribute to Miles concert with Wallace Roney.
Yeah, I was at the same show. I'm not sure at the time I understood everything that they were playing, but I was blown away by the intensity of these legends on stage playing this iconic music that, as a jazz student early in my college career, at that point, I was just beginning to kind of learn about and understand. But once again, because I actually took the time to attend an event, you have a completely different perspective.
Yeah. You know, my mom's 88. She's aging. You know, there will come a day when she's not around for me to talk to, but the amount of not just memories, experiences that I have that are musical because of her. And she wasn't a musician or anything, just an absolute music lover. Like, one of her favorite musicians is Jaco Pastorius. I mean, it seems so bizarre, you know, but because of those experiences, I will always remember a certain camaraderie with my mom that has influenced me playing music so deeply, because it was like we were two kids in a candy shop seeing these people. I got to see Miles Davis because of her, you know, You're Under Arrest tour.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so, man, what opportunities I had because of her. She wasn't even a musician, so the support for me was great. But here at the college, when I'm teaching, I'm constantly, I'm sure I sound like a nagging mom sometimes, you know, but I'm constantly saying, guys, who's in the scene that you want to get into? Do you know what musicians there are in Toronto that you would like to, you know? Yeah, I even try to put it this way. Whose job do you want to take when you graduate? Yeah. You know, but so few of them go to see live shows. But actually today, after this session here, somebody said to me, hey, we're going to see a live show tonight, just to make sure that I knew. I was like, yeah, good for you.
I've often found that I would go into work one day and then I'd be having a conversation over lunch about, you know, what we did the previous night. And I'll say, oh, I went to Toronto to see Paul Simon or whatever show. And people are like, hey, that's amazing. I would love to go see, you know, Paul Simon or whoever I went to see at the time. You got to let me know next time they come through. And I said, I'd be happy to. But last night was the last tour he was ever planning to do ever. And I was aware of that for so long because of the fact that I love these artists so much that I seek out when they're touring. I don't actually kind of wait to hear it afterwards. It's like, yeah, if I want to see something, I go online, I go to their website, I sign up for the mailing list, I seek out when these things are happening. So when things get announced, I'm already aware of this stuff because yeah, I don't want to miss these experiences that if you're not actively seeking out these opportunities, it's amazing the amount of opportunities and experiences that you actually will miss.
Yeah. You know, I feel like I'm in a zone for a few years now, where partly because of kids and some because I'm busy, family commitments, whatever, whether it's work or family stuff, you know, I'm not at as many concerts. And the price, oh my God.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to go see Stevie Wonder the last time he was here. And I was like, I don't have enough money. But, you know, it's only this part in my life that I'm doing it less, but I know it's going to come back. And I used to go out. I mean, when I was in college and after college, I would be out every week to see people play in the city, friends or people that I respected in the city. I mean, we have an incredible wealth of ability and talent here. You know, there's almost every night of the week, we can go see somebody in Toronto that's awesome and have a good time seeing live music. You know, I miss living downtown partly for that, because it was only 15 minutes away to everything.
Yes.
You know, I would go.
These days with traffic to Toronto, it's 45 minutes from Hamilton because I'm in Hamilton, but it's two and a half hour drive to Toronto. So right, that's also a deterrent as well. But, yeah, but there are just certain things that it's just, the challenge of getting there is the stressor, but the joy of the experience makes it worthwhile.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You started at a young age with a lot of encouragement from your mother.
Well, I didn't start till I was 16. I didn't play drums till I was 16, till I got into high school.
You developed a passion for music at a young age. When you got into high school, did you immediately, once you switched from trombone to the drum set, did you immediately kind of start a formal study, or did you start on your own?
I had lessons for a while with the guy that helped me, you know, develop some really basic skills so I could get into the high school. And then there were a couple of people at the high school. There was one guy at the high school, Michael Leary. I know he lives out west now, and I saw him a couple of years ago, but I took some lessons with him. And while he was a student at the high school, he was studying, I think at the time he was studying with Jim Blackley, had just started lessons with Jim Blackley. And so, you know, he took me under his wing, and I would go to his place, and he would give me and introduce me to drum set things that I had no idea about. And the thing I would thank him for the most is he would introduce me, you know, to music that I had never heard before. The drum lessons were awesome. He had such a passion for drums, and it was great. It was like so inspirational. But, you know, he just put on records and we play along, whether it was, you know, Al Jarreau, or it was Toto, or it was, you know, stuff like that. So it was because of him that I got into Steve Gadd and Jeff Beccaro and a few other drummers. It's just awesome.
Well, learning how to play the drums from the perspective of learning the music that inspires you gives you a completely different path in terms of becoming a musician as opposed to just learning how to play the drums. And I find, as an educator myself, one of the things that I often find interesting about sort of some of the younger sort of current generation is that they're inspired by the social media aspect of wanting to be a drummer, and they're not necessarily coming from the music path that we grew up coming from. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it's just interesting that, you know, we learned music and we expressed ourselves through the drums, whereas now people want to learn the drums and then maybe eventually express themselves through music.
Yeah, agreed. And you know, the interesting, I went on to study with Jim Blackley for a few years, and I would say almost all the teachers that I had along the way, I tried to study with a bunch of local teachers mm-hmm. and great players that were also teachers. The thing that I think I gleaned from each of them was they all taught some variation or something by, in the form of a concept rather mm-hmm. than teaching you a groove from a song. But then they would show me, listen, this is what they're doing, here's the sticking, and here's how you apply it. Or, you know, it's this type of groove, here's all the bass drum patterns. So consequently, I try to teach conceptually, but not forget that the whole reason for playing all of these bass drum variations is so I can play all of those songs, right? And I think that trying to constantly connect a concept to a piece of music that you can be moved by or at least identify what you're doing with is imperative. For expression anyway on the instrument. Yeah.
I spent a year studying with Jim Blackley about a year before he passed away. And it was a very profound sort of life-changing experience in terms of how I viewed the instrument, because he was very much my experience with him, because I studied with him when he was close to 90. My experience with him was that he was very much not someone that was going to tell you everything that you needed to learn. He would give you a situation and a scenario, and he would just leave you to get involved in that and to play along. And then eventually when he saw that you started to figure it out, he would then move you into kind of the next direction. So it was very much a almost like a guru type of scenario where he didn't give you all the answers. He gave you the experience and he wanted you to discover what it was that he was trying to open up to you conceptually. So I'm kind of curious about what your experience was like studying with Jim Blackley.
Similar in as much that I felt like, you know, I felt it wasn't just a student-teacher relationship, or, you know, maybe it was an old-school student-teacher relationship. I studied and trained martial arts for a very long time, and even for a couple of years, I had a teacher who was, you know, a Zen Buddhist monk, because that was just part of the path I was involved in at the time. And to me, there was that type of relationship with Jim. In the time when I studied with Jim, Jim was teaching out of his book, his first book, Syncopated Roles, but he was also teaching out of a host of other books as well, like Ralph Humphrey, Even in the Odds, and some Chet Nabeau stuff. And every single book, it didn't matter what book it was, you know, there was an approach to that book that where it was like, okay, well, here's the information, son, you know. Here's a way to practice it, but you need to go and listen to some music where this type of thing is involved in order to connect the dots. So this is the same thing as what you're saying. So I would go and I'd listen to like Don Ellis or Frank Zappa, very differently than, you know, before they were just names and it was like, wow, that's really cool. But now when we were talking about, you know, odd groupings and different ways of counting them, like different ways of playing in 9/8, whether you're using the twos or using 3/3s or 3/2s and a three and where you put the three, all that type of stuff. So I will go and actually try to listen to music and listen for that type of musical phrasing, the way the phrases turned, you know, and moved, and how you could manipulate different odd time signatures and make them feel. And man, I value that lesson a lot from Jim. He was great technically and stuff, but he really inspired me through him and taking a few lessons with this guy, John Riley. I feel like, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I teach, and I've written out exercises for people in different ways according to whatever concept I think is important at that time in our development here at the college. But it's always, 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 always connected to some sort of musical example and making sure that there is music involved. You know, I'm a big proponent of counting out loud or vocalizing something. Jim would make us, you know, say, like, I had to sing All of Me or something like that, and play all these groups of three, play all of his different groupings of three or even the extensions of five, but then sing the melody over top of that. And at first I just thought it was wacky, but wow, it really connected me to music in a very different way. And I do think that's imperative. And the way that he taught me, it's always in my brain, is make sure you have some sort of music example to cite for everything that I give. You know?
In addition to the private lessons that you have taken with multiple instructors, you also studied music at both York University and Humber College in Toronto. Looking at those post-secondary music experiences, what were some of the biggest challenges you faced, and what were some of the biggest hurdles that you overcame in those scenarios?
Time management, for sure, is a huge one. Staying excited about music and learning, and not getting caught up in self-deprecation. When I was at Humber College, I used to put a piece of paper over it because there were glass windows in the practice room, and I just thought, you know, I played in the fusion ensemble at Humber, which was an honor, and it was one of the three big chairs there, but I didn't feel deserving of it. Mm-hmm. You know, so I was way too self-deprecating, to the point where I probably didn't take in information or take chances and risks that would have led me to more learning. So that was a big takeaway from school. That's after the fact, you know, but there were some amazing journeys there at York. One of my favorite things that I did at York was really only three classes. John Brunel couldn't make it a few days, who was teaching the classical percussion or legit percussion there. And Trichy Shankaran came in and taught, you know, and really we didn't do anything on Murdungam or Kanjira. We just did counting. And that turned my head around. That made my head spin and my brain was exploding, you know, some of the things he could rhythmically do with his mouth while keeping a tala or time thing. And oh man, that was amazing. And now I have a bunch of those exercises that I do with my students here, because it's great for hearing phrases, you know, and being able to hear, you know, I hate to make it mathematical, but hear groupings in a time signature and then expanding on it. I think it's like the fastest way to connect to those things is verbally. And, you know, even if I'm just clapping or keeping some sort of count, whether it's four or seven or whatever, and then being able to sing the accents or sing the musical phrase, as Jim would say, you know, mm-hmm. That's like that from Trichy. It wasn't until years later, but those three classes I had with him, man, you know, and I know his daughter fairly well, Suba. I would love to go to Trichy's house one day and say, Trichy, man, thank you, because that was so badass.
Yeah. I went to Mohawk College and studied jazz performance for 3 years. And I often find now looking back, because that was 30 plus years ago, I'm starting to now embrace some of the lessons that I got from that experience. Because when you're in the post-secondary environment, you're so caught up in terms of completing your assignments, just, you know, passing the course, that you're doing the work, but yet you're so overwhelmed, you're not really taking the time to apply the concepts and really grow who you are as a player until you're well outside of those environments. And then you can look back and say, hey, now I'm starting to get this. And now that I don't have all of these other deadlines and things in front of me, you can start to kind of find some joy in the experiences that you kind of had from that. And I often find for me, some of the things that overwhelmed me at the time are the things that I'm so incredibly grateful now that I did, because there are things that I see other people struggle with that for me seems effortless because I invested so much time and dedication into learning these skills that at the time I didn't necessarily see where I was going to apply all of this stuff. But it's like a big cauldron of information, and you put it all in this, and then you mix it all together, and then everyone is going to take a different experience from that. But things that you may not have gravitated towards then suddenly hit you years later. So I think it's all really essential that we really look at these experiences with an open mind and know that we're going to take something away from everything, even if it's not intuitive or obvious at the time.
Yeah, 100%. I agree. Yeah. And you know, it's making, I'd like to believe it's making me a little more patient as I get older. Because as I see or feel things coming out that I've practiced last year, you know, and I go, oh, I can see that's impacting my playing this way now. I'm glad I was working on that. But why did it take a year? You know, that experience of growth and development over time. And when I'm teaching, I have to, this is the thing that's tough about giving marks at the college, is I have to give marks on something somebody's been practicing for 3 months. Yeah. How do I do that? You know, that's tough. So I do it, of course, based on a little bit of progression and effort put into it. But I know from my own experience, and thank you for validating it, that it happens to you too. It's you know, it's going to be years later that it really has an impact, you know, or hopefully it will have an impact, whatever we're doing with them now.
I remember when I was in college, I studied with Kevin Dempsey for 3 years, who's a renowned Toronto jazz musician, he's a character and quite the exceptional player, and he's a very tough teacher. And I remember at the time, you know, because I was 18, 19, 20 years old and insecure, being in this environment where I looked around and I felt like no matter how hard I worked, that everyone was further along than I was. And that's not always the case, but that's the perspective that you have when you're in those scenarios. And I remember he said to me in third year, because we're doing our auditions at the beginning to determine what ensemble you're going to go in. He goes, you're going to get one of the big bands. And I'm like, no way, because first of all, there's all these people who are way stronger players than I am. He's like, no, you're going to get a big band. And then I ended up getting one of the two big bands at the college. And I was really surprised by that, because I'm looking at the caliber of musicians that I got to be inspired by all the time. And he said, I knew you were going to get a big band because you're one of the strongest readers. He said, there's some people that are exceptional players, but you have developed a skill set in terms of reading that puts you at an advantage in these scenarios. And that's why I knew you were going to get one of the big bands. So you may look at these situations and say, yeah, it's hard to not get into the comparison trap when you're surrounded by people who are just excelling at all the things that you are working towards achieving. But at the same time, every single thing that you practice with focus and dedication is going to build your skill set. And everyone has value as a unique musician and as a unique individual. And some people that have value in certain situations are not necessarily of value in other situations. And then, so you really have to look at who you want to be, the skills that you want to have, and just focus on your own path and not get caught up in other people's journeys. And I remember, I think he and I had a conversation about this once, probably in first or second year, how I felt overwhelmed by the level of talent that I was around. And it wasn't a competitive environment. We were all very supportive of each other, but there's still that insecurity aspects. And what he said to me was, don't be a sheep, be a leader. Don't just try and do what everyone else is doing. Just figure out what your direction is and just lead your own path. And so I always had to keep going back to that mindset and realize I'm not on their path. I'm on my own path. And I don't know where that's going to take me, but I'm going to invest the time into my art and my skills. And then that, and just be open to the experiences that get presented to me.
And what's nice about that is then you come out in the music, right? Like, it's really your personality, your style. You can't get away from it, you know, because you're not busy copying. For me, I feel like I'm a jack of all trades, master of none, you know? But when I think about what I like, what I listen to, what has inspired me over the years, what I'd like to continue to do, or new things come my way, it's like, well, there's still an aspect of so many different styles of music and ways of playing that are involved in what I see or hopefully get to experience in my future. I don't want to change that path. I'm not going to, you know, especially at my age, I'm not going to end up immersing myself in the Cuban culture just to be like a Daphne Prieto or somebody like that. That guy is not only is he incredible, but his personality just bubbles in his playing, and it's beautiful to experience and watch. But, you know, I also, you know, one of my favorite artists is Bill Withers. I get to play music that's like that. For me, there's no diminution, or what's the correct word there? I don't feel diminished in any way to play what most people might think is a simple pattern, because simple's not easy.
No.
You know? And the music moves me. So ultimately, that's why I'm making music, is because something moves me.
Over the years, I've done lots of different sorts of things. I'm not playing live as much as I used to, because I'm focusing now on recording or just education in terms of just kind of building my skill set and just kind of finding my passion. And I think one of the things that I'm looking at is, it doesn't matter what scenario I'm in, the thing that is most important to me is I want to do things that bring me joy. And I want to put things into situations that challenge me, but in the end, I want to sit back and go, okay, that was something that I always wanted to achieve. And I think when you're always just kind of trying to make a living, there's a lot of scenarios that we're in that we kind of have to do because we have to make a living. But I think as we get older, we start to pick and choose things a little bit more, and we realize that our focus is really about joy and just really bringing passion to the things that are essential to us.
Yeah. You know, somebody had said to me years ago, there's got to be two of three things for me to say yes to a gig. You know, there's good money, great people, great musicianship, you know. And I feel lucky that as the older I get, there's more often two things firmly in place in everything that I get to do, which is awesome and lovely. But there's also some passion projects I would play for nothing for, because I started playing drums without the idea of there being money. And yeah, I gotta pay for my kids, and I'm happy to feed them, you know. I feel joy in going to work, doing what I love to do, and feeding my kids at the same time. My wife is an incredible singer, like deadly awesome singer, and it's taking years to get her album done. If we could ever play that music live, I'd be like, honey, you don't have to pay me. I'll play this for free. You know what I mean? Like, she's a killer singer. Her tunes are great. I'm moved by them. And I have some friends that if they call and they say, hey, you want to do a gig on whatever, if it's open, I don't even ask what the music is or what the money is. I will definitely say yes to some people, you know?
Because there's joy in that experience.
Absolutely. I know that playing with them is going to be filled with joy, you know?
Now, one of the things that you've been involved in over the years that I find a lot of inspiration is that you've been actively involved in the musical and the Broadway scene, often in a sub in a lot of these situations for a lot of really big productions in Toronto, including Hamilton and Juliet, Bat Out of Hell, Dear Evan Hansen, and I'm sure there's numerous other ones at different levels that you've been involved in. So how did you get involved in that scene, and how does that scene speak to your desire to overcome and embrace a challenge?
Well, in terms of overcoming a challenge, there has not been anything that I've ever done as stressful as subbing into a musical theater gig. It is by far the most stressful environment. I was talking to Mark Kelso about this last week, 2 weeks ago. And yeah, he said, yeah, that's like the most stressful environment. I'm glad that he even commiserated with me. There's nothing that guy can't play.
Oh yeah.
But as much as I know this isn't popular with some people, I got lucky with doing the theater thing. I can read well. I'm definitely not like a Terry Clark or Mark Kelso reader, but I read well. I play a lot of different styles well. I play with a track and a loop well. I can't say I'm the best at any of those things. Well, and I wouldn't want to. But I think because all of those skill sets are at a certain level, I can do the work. And then when this guy, Chris Sutherland, awesome drummer, just moved to New York, asked me to do Bat Out of Hell, I thought, well, that's ridiculous. Yeah, let's do it. You know what I mean? It was like, yeah, there's a challenge. And so that was really the first big musical that I had done. And I had only done a couple of small musical things beside that. But I've got a background. I played in the Toronto Youth Symphony for years. So I had enough of a diverse background. And to be honest, enough of a joy for all sorts of different music. Like, I know there's guys in the scene from conversations I've had, they do one style of music well, and then they say, well, I could do that, no problem, sure, whatever. And it's just this. And I think, wow, there are details in every style of music that make it exceptionally challenging, mm-hmm. whether it's country, rock, R&B, jazz, whatever. And I think we do a disservice to ourselves as musicians, as humans, to not care enough about those details, So I would say that mentality, it makes me a good fit for doing musicals. And then after doing the first one, I thought, hey, this is cool. I like this. Not only are my drums set up, the production's nice, the mix is nice. Those guys playing on the floor are wicked musicians. There was a little bit of a little kid thing going on. If I'm in the pit and I get to play next to Pat Kilbride playing bass, and the show sounds really good, man, I'm on cloud nine. That's amazing.
I actually had an interview with Chris Sutherland in an earlier episode, and we spent a lot of time talking about kind of working in that particular scene. And one of the things that we talked about is that, even though the band is out of sight, a lot of times you're down below in the orchestra pit, the audience expectation is that everything is going to sound exactly like the record they have at home. So there is not really freedom to kind of change and adapt and get through things. You're hired even as a sub in these situations to get it right. And there's a learning curve to this, but even at the beginning, the expectation is you're here and you're going to play it right because everyone in the audience, that's the expectation.
Sure. And from the MD and from everybody else in the pit, although, everybody's forgiving because it's hard to play a perfect show. Yes. But, there is that expectation. And part of that is a fun part of the challenge. That's not necessarily my favorite music to make, but I would say I more than like it. Like, mm-hmm. I love that challenge, and I like doing that, and it's amazing going to work to play some of that music. Even if I don't particularly vibe with all of the music in the show, man, I get to go to work, play music, play in a great band, killer band for a night, and push myself, which I also enjoy, subbing into all of those shows was extraordinarily stressful and super joyful. It's a weird mix, but it was great. It was lots of fun. And, you know, hopefully there'll be more in the future. And subbing into those shows was great. Playing the show and Juliet was like playing like a pop, rock, funk, R&B show. So, yeah, what could be bad, you know?
So, as we talked about earlier, you've been a faculty member at Metalworks Institute for the last number of years. Are you primarily teaching private lessons there, or do you actually teach in a classroom environment?
Yeah, I teach. The curriculum or the courses change a little bit have changed over the years a bit to suit the needs of the students coming in. But I've taught rhythm reading courses, which I don't know if we're bringing back or not. I hope so. But I teach what's called a musicianship, a master class for drummers. And that's different than the private lessons. I'll introduce concepts in musicianship, but really try to make it contextual to music, either styles or recording techniques, period. And then in the private lesson, I get to go a little bit deeper with the students in, you know, related to the material from musicianship. I teach an ensemble, and I get to teach a post-production class, which is just, an introduction to different musical instruments. And then again, contextualizing that so that they have an idea if they're doing their own album or they get into production in some way, they understand the use of an instrument, the range of an instrument, stuff like that. So it's a few different courses. It's great. I love it.
And you've been teaching there for a number of years now, and you've probably seen the program change as the current musical climate changes.
Yeah. I've been here since 2012, the beginning of 2012. The climate has changed drastically just since COVID alone, but it's changed since the beginning to now without COVID. But with COVID, it's a completely different group of students. They're different humans, you know?
Now, based on the experiences that you have and looking at this institute and environments, what do you find are some of the biggest challenges that the students need to overcome? And how are you able to assist them based on the experiences and things that you have gone through?
There are some challenges that are the same. I recognize that are the same as when I was in school. Time management is not most people's friend.
Yeah.
You know, the motivation to play is different for a lot of students now. So finding, tapping into where their passion is and how to allow their passion to drive them to do something they don't necessarily want to do, you know, that's a challenge. You know, I have a background in psychotherapy from the Gestalt Institute. I was there for 3 years. And I'd say I implement that learning almost more than my musical learning. Because keeping people focused is exceptionally difficult right now. Even since, 2012, I would say the first 4 to 5 years of teaching here, there were a lot more students that had a greater, they had more time. They could focus, let's say, for 10 or 20 minutes, no problem. And then they might lose focus. Now, I would say that number is about a third. Mm-hmm. You know, like, if I can keep somebody focused for 5 minutes, then I try to, you know, change the subject for a second and then come back to it. And I know how to talk a lot. So I have to remind myself that step back for a second to stop talking for a minute and let them refocus. I would say focus and time management are two of the biggest challenges, which have nothing to do with actually playing the instrument. Of course, they aid in playing the instrument, but if you can't get past that, it's difficult to get the information and then retain the information, right? Because it has to go from a conceptual understanding to the practice room, but then, you know, you're not with them in the practice room. And so trying to give them steps to, and get them to take steps for instance, you know, set a timer. I tell my students all the time, set a timer. If all you got in you is 2 minutes, set a timer for 2 minutes, stop, and then come back. But it's very hard to implement those type of things. And I try to get them to do practice journals as well. But
when I was a student in college, one of the guest artists that we had come in was Marvin Smitty Smith.
Yeah, us too.
Renowned jazz drummer. And one of the questions that got asked to him was, you know, the student presented the situation and said, I'm dedicated to practicing drums for 5 hours a day. And so then I'll go through and I'll work an hour on technique and I'll work an hour on reading and I'll, you know, I'll work an hour on this independent. And he went through and he said, and I want your opinion in terms of how to best use that time. And he said, you should spend 20 minutes working on all of that stuff, and you should spend 4.5 hours playing music and applying the things that you learn. He said, because if you're always just dedicating on learning the craft but never actually developing the craft, you're wasting your time. And I think for me, one of the things that I've learned over the years, because I'm still dedicated to taking lessons and I'm still dedicated to bettering myself. And for me, I find great passion and joy about knowing that I'm never going to learn everything. And there's just such a wealth of information out there. But what I've learned was, because I've studied with so many people, I've learned how to learn. Whereas going back 30 years ago, I was told what to learn. And so now I'm going back to things that I learned, you know, in my early 20s and revisiting them because I've learned a skill set now in terms of, you know, making a practice journal, you know, focusing my practice time to 20 minutes to half an hour of day of dedicated practice and know that I'm going to work on this concept for 5 minutes with great focus and then move on to the next concept. And I know exactly what I'm going to do when I come down into my practice room, whereas often when you're learning, you are told what to learn, and then you're told to practice for 3 hours a day. And you can't get better without focus just by putting the extra time in. So it's how to learn is a skill set in addition to what to learn.
Yeah. And it's funny because Marvin came to our, to Humber as well. And man, it's funny that he said that to you guys, because I don't remember him saying that to anybody. And I remember thinking, my God, how many hours a day? You probably play drums more hours than you walk or breathe, yeah, man. Caffeine is deadly. Oh my God. You know?
And it's all about, you know, like the practical applications. You want to learn something, but then you want to apply the things that you learn. And it's through that experience that you just start to develop your own style and you determine the things that really have value to you. I'm never going to be the strongest Latin player, but I love learning the style because I take different elements from the things that I've learned and it shows up in other aspects of my playing. And I think that's one of the things that's fun, is you can't master everything, but you can never stop the journey of just trying to get better and to stay inspired.
Yeah, that's for sure. You know, it's I think lately I've been practicing more than I was 5 or 6 years ago. And some of my practice time is like, oh, I got to get the time in. But when I start, I'm like, oh, I don't want to stop. Nope, yeah. My timer. I'm ignoring my timer. You know, I think I enjoy playing more now than I did 10 years ago. There's times where it's still a job and it's still stuff that it's like, okay, you've got to do this because this gig requires that type of practice. That's fine. That doesn't bug me. It's not as motivating sometimes as some of the things I'd rather be working on, but I think I'm enjoying it more now than I did a while ago. I'm not sure exactly why, but I do.
Now, you have been involved in multiple projects over the years, looking back and not getting into all of them, but are there any particular things that you've done that you're most proud of or think best represent who you are as a creative player?
Yeah, there have been a couple of bands that in terms of my personality and me being an equal artistic contributing member. Yeah, there's a few projects that I'm sad aren't still around. You know, I played with this band, Special Ed and the Musically Challenged, for a number of years. I think we did five or six albums. And then for Ed, I played on a few other ones. Ed Roman, very creative guy and really outside the box. But that band had the attitude that I was like, okay, if you got an idea, bring it to the table. And it really, it wasn't like, okay, instead of playing 16th notes on the hi-hat, I'm going to play 8th. What do you think? They were like, he was like, go and find something totally different. Oh, you want to play textural? You want to play this in 6/8? Or, you know, he'd have sections where we'd be playing like a Prince type groove, and I can't think of the name of the tune on Diamonds and Pearls. I stole this groove from that. But then we go into a big band section, completely different time. Not just time signature, but a shift in time and everything. And then we get back in. And it was really a situation that was like Zappa light, but everybody was a contributing member to what was going on musically. That situation at that time was filled with so much musical joy, and it felt like a camaraderie, and we were brothers, you know. They're still, while I don't get to make music with any of them anymore, they're lovely humans and creative people that I respect immensely, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a fun time.
Now, are there any current projects that you are involved in that you're particularly excited or inspired by?
Yeah, there's a couple. You know, as soon as we get my wife's album done, playing it will be great. And I'm getting to co-produce and mix that album, which is awesome and a lot of work. But musically, I also love that. I think my wife is an incredible singer. Her name's Wendy Irvin. And she's an amazing singer. But also in that group, I play with this guy, Ian D'Souza, this bass player, who's one of my favorite musicians in life. He's one of my favorite people. And anytime he's on a gig, I'm there no matter what. I'll be there because I know nobody's going to hire Ian unless they want some creative vibe happening. Mm-hmm. You know, and Ian is a guy who listens immensely well. So I've played in a few projects with Ian. So anything with Ian, I would say yes to, and anything that I do with Ian these days is amazing. But you know, I, for instance, next Friday on the 22nd, I'm in Kitchener playing a Jeff Beck tribute with this guitarist Michael Murray and his band, and I think I'm a long-term sub on that gig. Man, I liked Jeff Beck before, but now I love Jeff Beck. Because of diving into the music, you know, mm-hmm. and really listening and playing with those guys is a lot of fun. And there's a lot of room for me to be me, even though it's somebody else's music. So that's a really fun project as well. Yeah. So there are a couple of things. Yeah.
When you first started out in your professional career, what did success mean to you? And how has your vision of success changed over the years?
You know, maybe some people would think my bar is set low, but success for me hasn't changed over the years. What's changed is my personal landscape. So I always thought that success was if I could make a living playing music and be somewhat comfortable, and I didn't equate that to driving a specific car, but more to providing, you know, and comfortably providing, like, yeah, we have no problems eating. That to me was successful because I saw a lot of musicians with jobs they didn't want to have, and a lot of musicians quit playing professionally because they didn't have enough money. That hasn't changed. What has changed is the demand for more dollars. You know, the cost of living, having kids and having a family in this business is really, really tough, especially now. Look, when I did my first few jingles, that was at the end of the heyday of jingles. And the amount that I got paid for a session back then probably equals about 6 to 8 sessions now. You know, it was incredible if they would buy it out. And the union, of course, was involved in all session work back then. And at that time, the people that were playing on all the sessions were purchasing multiple houses in the city. So, you know, I missed out on that being a part of my income, but got to partake in it enough to have a taste of it to know that, okay, if I can perpetuate enough work doing things that I like to do, session work or whatever, that at least I would still be able to do a little bit better than just stay afloat, you know? So that's always been my measure of success. But my real measure of success is, can I stay happy doing this? You know, which is not easy some days, but, you know.
Yeah. I think that's, in some cases, the box that people forget to check off. They look at all the other things they want to achieve, but they forget to look at it as, is this really what I want to do? Is this make you happy? And I think that's something we kind of just always need to get back to revisit and make sure we reevaluate our situations to ensure that our well-being, our mental health, and our satisfaction with our art is something that is a priority in our lives, as well as the relationships that we have with our friends and family.
Definitely. And, you know, making music with making a lot of different types of music with a lot of different people has also been rewarding. That wasn't necessarily on my docket in the beginning, but now, you know, there are less cliques in the way now because people want to work with more people. They want their community to be larger, you know, the people they work with. So, and the beautiful part of that is there's a lot more people out there that are great musicians and nice people than I recognized before. And that's changed because I think at one point I thought if I could be a part of a few different groups and make a living, that would be fantastic. And now I don't know how possible that is, but now it's like, oh, I get to do a session with these people this week. And in a week or two, I'm doing a different session with those people. And then this show with these guys and that show with these. That is a blessing, you know.
If people are interested in seeing more about the work that you've done or to reach out and connect with you, what's the best way to do that?
I don't know. I'd have to go on YouTube and find it.
You have a good YouTube page, by the way. So.
Do I? Yeah. I can't even remember. I don't think I've uploaded anything in years. So thank you. Thank you. But is that my page, the Dave Patel Drums page?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. So DavePatelDrums@gmail.com is definitely the easiest way to get in touch with me. I honestly can't remember what's up on that page. But that said, you know, there are some concert footage from concerts. Like I played with this guy, Emmanuel Jal, at the Montreal Jazz Festival 5 or 6 years ago. And it was such a joy. Like I won't ever forget that concert, you know? I think that's floating around out there. There's a bunch of different people. Yeah, I'm terrible at keeping track. Sorry.
I think that the work that you do is top notch. I think one of the things that I admire about you is that you have such a positive and welcoming attitude in terms of working with different musicians. You do a fantastic job of sort of building and supporting the community. And I'm always very excited to see what's next on your list. Dave, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Michael, thank you. For me too. It's so great to talk to you.
Okay. All the best.
Thank you. You too.
You've been listening to the Drummer's Pathway podcast. Please share and subscribe, get the word out, and let's keep the discussion going. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.